history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, the stories waiting to be told right there where you live will really amaze you if you take a little time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do so, we learn so much. Yes, we're educated, we're entertained. So often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. There have been so many books written about World War II, many of them by veterans you've heard from on this program. And Hollywood has produced more than its fair share of films, some of which take more liberties than others. But as Veterans Day weekend approaches, there's a World War II-themed film about to hit theaters nationwide. It's just a one-word title, Midway. And it bills itself as a historically accurate depiction of a pivotal moment in World War II. Here's a clip from the film's trailer that underscores the stakes in the Battle of Midway, which took place over the span of 4 days, 77 years ago, just 6 months after the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, when America needed to shift the momentum of the war in the Pacific.
Pearl Harbor is the greatest intelligence failure in American history.
This can never happen again. I want to make it right.
At least some of the boys still want to fight.
The Japanese are planning something bigger.
So what's the target?
We believe it's Midway.
Washington disagrees.
Washington is wrong.
If we lose, the Japanese own the West Coast. Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles.
We got the order to launch.
We need to throw a punch so they know what it feels like to be hit.
We're talking about a couple dozen planes against all Japanese fleet. This isn't a fair fight. I don't know how to lead these men. You know that you came through when people are counting on you. You'll be able to face anything.
You can watch that film trailer online. I even have it up for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Midway opens in theaters nationwide on November 8th, and it'll relate the story of one of World War II's most stunning victories to a whole new audience. I don't think everyone who passes through Chicago's Midway Airport realizes it was named after a World War II battle thousands of miles away, unfolding in the water and the skies around a tiny group of islands in the Pacific Ocean. It was a major turning point, perhaps the biggest because of its timing and the consequences. If you've ever been to San Diego, perhaps you've visited the USS Midway Museum, an aircraft carrier commissioned just after the end of World War II and also named for that decisive battle. It also happens to be one of the best places to learn the history of the Battle of Midway, in addition to dozens of aircraft throughout that massive carrier that tourists from around the world have visited every day for the last 15 years now. The museum ship describes in vivid detail those crucial 4 days at Midway that changed the war, and thus changed the world. Carl Zingheim is the ship historian for the USS Midway Museum.
One misconception we have to correct is to let people know that, no, this ship did not fight in the Battle of Midway. It's actually named for the action. To help bring that story back to life, we do have a holographic cinema that's specially constructed in our forward hangar bay that encapsulates what was at stake in that pivotal battle in 1942, as well as some displays out in front that provide a little more graphic detail about the action and the forces involved and such. So what's really nice about that approach is that between the conventional graphic presentations outside and the unique holographic experience on the inside is that you're really covering as many different aspects of the human nature of that action as we could possibly put in a brief period of time.
And I know you welcome from time to time guys who were involved in that battle, that were on aircraft carriers at Midway, maybe that flew in dive bombers at Midway, that saw the destruction, the explosions, the gunfire, the death, all of that. What have you gleaned from that? And if you had to encapsulate the significance of Midway here on the ship that bears its name, how do you explain that to somebody who says, well, what was the Battle of Midway?
Probably what would set Midway apart from other significant actions that had consequences afterwards, and I certainly see this with the people who attend, particularly the veterans of Midway who attend the annual Battle of Midway commemorations, is that individual actions still matter. At Midway, a lot of things could have gone one way or another had a decision been made going one way or the other. For example, we had a torpedo squadron commander who disobeyed a directive on what direction to fly with his opinion that he had a better idea where the Japanese actually would be. Tragically, he was proven correct, and his squadron went in completely unsupported. But he made that decision. Then we've got others where a dive bomber pilot who was leading a squadron was trying to set up for an attack, but the entire group leader, who was actually a fighter pilot, decided, everyone follow me. And before he knew it, two entire squadrons are piling in on his target and completely ignoring another one right nearby. So he broke off his attack, formulated a new plan in the middle of the action, and delivered an improvised attack on the other carrier. So these are really instances where the split reactions or the brave decisions, regardless of the consequences that individuals can make in time of distress or in time of combat, can really come to the front. And what's strange about Midway is that it seems to be an action of consequence where the individual decisions really did matter.
And have you gotten a feel over the years in interacting with those gentlemen who were there, what it means for them to have this here, that they can come back to a ship named the Midway and see each other and relive those moments and understand the significance and everything that would have been different had they not prevailed in such dramatic fashion there?
Well, we certainly get that from the Midway veterans themselves, and that could be completely understandable. But what's remarkable about what you've just expressed is that it seems to cut across all the generations, all the people who served in carrier aviation over the decades that we've been blessed to host on board for various events. So this is actually a sentiment of service and dedication and, frankly, skill in a demanding profession that cuts across the boundaries of time and of the generations. And so we see that, of course, with the Midway veterans and the rest of the World War II veterans. But it also applies as much to the people who fought in Korea, to the people who flew routine missions at night and during the Cold War, the Vietnam veterans, all the way up through Desert Storm veterans we recently hosted on the ship. So those are sentiments, actually, that I have seen myself that really cut across the generations and apply to everyone who's been called upon to serve.
And you mentioned the holographic situation there. You also have some flight simulators here where people can get a feel for what it's actually like to fly one of these planes?
Even though we've got museum in our name, we're not strictly a place of static exhibits and dry displays and maybe a few people who talk about things. We've got much more to offer than that to our community here in San Diego. We have full-motion flight simulators that you can actually pilot as you're flying a mission profile with the ability to actually loop and roll while someone's shooting at you. So you've got at least a partial example of what it was like to fly missions in World War II, thanks to that technology.
And speaking of technology, advances in undersea technology have allowed some of the wreckage from the Battle of Midway to be discovered. More than 20 years ago now, Robert Ballard discovered the only American carrier to be sunk at Midway, the USS Yorktown. And just in the last month, the research vessel Petrel continued its list of remarkable finds by discovering not just one, but two of the four Japanese carriers sunk in the battle. The next time you're in San Diego, I hope you'll visit the Midway Museum. It's moored just below the Broadway Pier, and you can spend all day there. Thanks again to ship historian Carl Zingheim for explaining some of how the Midway Museum preserves the history of the battle for which that ship was named. We actually did an entire episode at the Midway Museum a couple years ago, and you can access that as well as any of our 600 episodes at hometownheroesradio.com. The major Hollywood production Midway opens in theaters November 8th. And how many people do you know who say, when a well-publicized film is about to debut, make sure you read the book before you watch the movie. There have been, of course, plenty of books written about the Battle of Midway, and here on Hometown Heroes, we've heard plenty of first-person perspectives on the battle, the prelude, the aftermath, the impact. And I thought hearing some of those today would be a good way to prepare for the Midway movie's debut. It's rated PG-13, by the way, mostly because of the realistic scenes of naval and aerial combat. Again, this battle took place just 6 months after Pearl Harbor, and four Japanese carriers that had launched the planes that devastated American forces at Oahu on December 7, 1941, would all be sunk at Midway in June of 1942. The big difference between Midway and Pearl Harbor was that this time the Americans had an idea of what was coming. That was thanks to cryptanalysts who believed they had cracked the Japanese code because of intercepted messages and how they were interpreted. Admiral Chester Nimitz had a pretty good guess of not just where Japan would attack, but when and with how much force. And there are so many what-ifs when it comes to World War II, but this is a big one. If you've studied the Battle of Midway at all, you know the aircraft carrier Enterprise and all the planes she launched played a major, major role in this pivotal American victory. But the Enterprise was there at full strength because of some providential weather 6 months earlier. The Big E was supposed to be at Pearl Harbor when the Japanese attacked in December. If it had been, it very likely would have not only been sunk, but would have trapped all the other ships in the harbor. At least that's what we heard here on Hometown Heroes from Merle Twibel, who would later be credited with saving that famed aircraft carrier. He had been in the Navy since 1935.
Well, the Enterprise, we went to Hawaii then in 1939, and we'd been there, of course, a couple of years, and we were on the way back from Wake Island, where we had delivered the Marine fighter planes. And on the way back, we were due at the sea buoy at 0600 on the Sunday morning. Well, we got into a storm, and the destroyers with us had to ballast back down again until, so it delayed our arrival back to Pearl Harbor until 1600 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the sea buoy. Had we have been on time and hadn't stopped the fuel, the Enterprise would have been in Hospital Point. And we would have been blocked the whole Pearl Harbor, probably, because that's what the Japanese were looking for, and they wondered, where the hell are those aircraft carriers? Well, what we heard, we got there, and we heard something happen. We sent our air group into Pearl, and we said, it's just another Sunday drill. So we did, and here we are, we're wasting time. We want to get in and go on Liberty. And then pretty soon, some of our air group come back, and they said, this ain't no drill. And several of them then got shot down, and from there on, well, it was a matter of general quarters and get ready. And then we went into Pearl, actually, then Monday night. And if you've seen that mess, why, that was something. Then we stayed about 4 hours and took on fuel and ammunition and food stuff, and then we got back out of there. And, of course, we knew about the little submarines by that time. And that we went through Hospital Point, making about 25 knots. We threw a wake clear up over the top of the deal when we went out. It was something.
Well, and you just said, if you saw what that looked like at that time, you'd never forget it. What did you see when you headed into Pearl Harbor? I'm sure you could see the smoke from the Arizona, but was it shocking to you? I mean, could you believe your eyes? Did you have any concept of how significant this was in the big picture?
Well, by that time, we knew what had happened, how many planes had attacked, and it was just one of those things that happens to you in a lifetime, and you look at it, and you wonder how we're going to get out. But we got out of there, and then we went looking for the Japs, and finally, fortunately, we didn't find them because we weren't ready for anything. At that time, then, I was had the machine shop and the elevators and all that, and it was just a matter of going to general quarters and still in the repair parties and drilling like we were and just waiting to see what would happen. And, of course, that's the whole idea of everybody out there was just after when we got back out of Pearl is to we milled around out there, what's going to happen? We wait and see. Actually, we prepared then to go out and to the Marshall Islands and bomb them. Well, in the meantime, all the bombs they had aboard the Enterprise were armor-piercing bombs. So they went over and they borrowed a bunch of bombs from the Army. Well, I was, of course, had the machine shop, and after they got them aboard, well, then they found out that the Navy fuses wouldn't fit the Army bombs. So if we were then, I and the rest of people in the machine shop, we spent the next 3 or 4 days of making adapters so we could fit them into the bombs and screw our fuses on them. So we were pretty busy while we were headed for Wake Island and that. And then, of course, after we bombed the Marshall Islands and that, why, they secured from general quarters, and we thought, well, that's fix the Japs. But while we were up there looking at the islands burn, all of a sudden there was two twin-end Mitsubishis came out, and they almost got they hit this after the star or port quarters of the fantail of the ship, and they started a fire back there, kind of touched it with their wing. Well, that's when we learned that, hey, those guys will crash on you if they get a chance. We didn't think anybody would do that, but we found that out. And then, of course, after that, then it was a matter of days and days, just seeking in the Battle of Midway, and then, which we were rebricking some boilers and doing a lot of repair work during the Battle of Midway, and the Yorktown got sunk.
And we're going to hear from a survivor of the USS Yorktown sinking in a bit, but I want to draw some more attention to what you heard Merle Twible say there. The bombs that sunk those four Japanese carriers at Midway, such as the Akagi, which was just discovered this month by the crew of the RV Petrel, had this adjustment in the machine shop of the USS Enterprise not taken place? Had Merle Twible and his crew not rethreaded all these fuse adapters, those American bombs, at least from the carrier Enterprise, might not have produced the same kind of results.
We had the bomb right there, and we could measure the threads and all of that, and that it was kind of like an adapter on a pipe fitting where you take it, and that's all it were threads. And we had to make an internal thread where our bomb fuse would screw in, and the one would screw into the Army bomb. And that, because what happened, they wanted these bombs to blow up above ground, not dig in the ground with our armor piercing. Because armor piercing, they'd just blow up a hole and that'd be it. And that was the reason they did it.
And I guess at that point, you'd probably gotten way past being nervous working around bombs. Is that anything that bothered you at first, the first time you had to work on a bomb?
No, bombs and rockets and stuff on carriers and 100-octane gas is just something you live with. And if you catch somebody smoking, you push them over the side.
That was Merle Twible, who a few months after Midway would be credited with saving the most decorated ship in U.S. naval history, the USS Enterprise. That had to do with an adaptation to a breathing apparatus that greatly increased the ability to fight fires on the carrier. That came in very, very handy. Merle passed away in 2009, but you can access his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com to explore the rest of that unique contribution to the Enterprise's legendary record. Still to come, we'll hear from someone flying in one of the Big E's planes in the Battle of Midway, which will become known to a whole new generation of Americans thanks to the movie Midway, which opens in theaters November 8th. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
History. Through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes. Proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, the stories waiting to be told right there where you live will really amaze you if you take a little time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do so, we learn so much. Yes, we're educated, we're entertained. So often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. There have been so many books written about World War II, many of them by veterans you've heard from on this program. And Hollywood has produced more than its fair share of films, some of which take more liberties than others. But as Veterans Day weekend approaches, there's a World War II-themed film about to hit theaters nationwide. It's just a one-word title, Midway. And it bills itself as a historically accurate depiction of a pivotal moment in World War II. Here's a clip from the film's trailer that underscores the stakes in the Battle of Midway, which took place over the span of 4 days, 77 years ago, just 6 months after the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, when America needed to shift the momentum of the war in the Pacific.
Pearl Harbor is the greatest intelligence failure in American history.
This can never happen again.
I want to make it right.
At least some of the boys still want to fight.
The Japanese are planning something bigger.
So what's the target?
We believe it's Midway.
Washington disagrees.
Washington is wrong.
If we lose, then Japanese own the West Coast. Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles. Burn.
We got the order to launch.
We need to throw a punch so they know what it feels like to be hit.
We're talking about a couple dozen planes. It's all Japanese fleet. This isn't a fair fight. I don't know how to lead these men.
You know that you came through when people are counting on you. You'll be able to face anything.
You can watch that film trailer online. I even have it up for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Midway opens in theaters nationwide on November 8th, and it'll relate the story of one of World War II's most stunning victories to a whole new audience. I don't think everyone who passes through Chicago's Midway Airport realizes it was named after a World War II battle thousands of miles away, unfolding in the water and the skies around a tiny group of islands in the Pacific Ocean. It was a major turning point, perhaps the biggest because of its timing and the consequences. If you've ever been to San Diego, perhaps you visited the USS Midway Museum, an aircraft carrier commissioned just after the end of World War II and also named for that decisive battle. It also happens to be one of the best places to learn the history of the Battle of Midway, in addition to dozens of aircraft throughout that massive carrier that tourists from around the world have visited every day for the last 15 years now. The museum ship describes in vivid detail those crucial 4 days at Midway that changed the war, and thus changed the world. Carl Zingheim is the ship historian for the USS Midway Museum.
One misconception we have to correct is let people know that, no, this ship did not fight in the Battle of Midway. It's actually named for the action. To help bring that story back to life, we do have a holographic cinema that's specially constructed in our forward hangar bay that encapsulates what was at stake in that pivotal battle in 1942, as well as some displays out in front that provide a little more graphic detail about the action and the forces involved and such. So what's really nice about that approach is that between the conventional graphic presentations outside and the unique holographic experience on the inside is that you're really covering as many different aspects of the human nature of that action as we could possibly put in a brief period of time.
And I know you welcome from time to time guys who were involved in that battle, that were on aircraft carriers at Midway, maybe that flew in dive bombers at Midway, that saw the destruction, the explosions, the gunfire, the death. all of that. What have you gleaned from that? And if you had to encapsulate the significance of Midway here on the ship that bears its name, how do you explain that to somebody who says, well, what was the Battle of Midway?
Probably what would set Midway apart from other significant actions that had consequences afterwards, and I certainly see this with the people who attend, particularly the veterans of Midway who attend the annual Battle of Midway commemorations, is that individual actions still matter. At Midway, a lot of things could have gone one way or another had a decision been made going one way or the other. For example, we had a torpedo squadron commander who disobeyed a directive on what direction to fly with his opinion that he had a better idea where the Japanese actually would be. Tragically, he was proven correct, and his squadron went in completely unsupported. But he made that decision. Then we've got others where a dive bomber pilot who was leading a squadron was trying to set up for an attack, but the entire group leader, who was actually a fighter pilot, decided, everyone follow me. And before he knew it, two entire squadrons are piling in on his target and completely ignoring another one right nearby. So he broke off his attack, formulated a new plan in the middle of the action, and delivered an improvised attack on the other carrier. So these are really instances where the split reactions or the brave decisions, regardless of the consequences that individuals can make in time of distress or in time of combat, can really come to the front. And what's strange about Midway is that it seems to be an action of consequence where the individual decisions really did matter.
And have you gotten a feel over the years in interacting with those gentlemen who were there what it means for them to have this here, that they can come back to a ship named the Midway and see each other and relive those moments and understand the significance and everything that would have been different had they not prevailed in such dramatic fashion there?
Well, we certainly get that from the Midway veterans themselves, and that could be completely understandable. But what's remarkable about what you've just expressed is that it seems to cut across all the generations, all the people who served in carrier aviation over the decades that we've been blessed to host on board for various events. So this is actually a sentiment of service and dedication and, frankly, skill in a demanding profession that cuts across the boundaries of time and of the generations. And so we see that, of course, with the Midway veterans and the rest of the World War II veterans. But it also applies as much to the people who fought in Korea, to the people who flew routine missions at night and during the Cold War, the Vietnam veterans, all the way up through Desert Storm veterans we recently hosted on the ship. So those are sentiments, actually, that I have seen myself that really cut across the generations and apply to everyone who's been called upon to serve.
And you mentioned the holographic situation there. You also have some flight simulators here where people can get a feel for what it's actually like to fly one of these planes?
Even though we've got museum in our name, we're not strictly a place of static exhibits and dry displays and maybe a few people who talk about things. We've got much more to offer than that to our community here in San Diego. We have full motion flight simulators that you can actually pilot as you're flying a mission profile, with the ability to actually loop and roll while someone's shooting at you. So you've got at least a partial example of what it was like to fly missions in World War II, thanks to that technology.
And speaking of technology, advances in undersea technology have allowed some of the wreckage from the Battle of Midway to be discovered. More than 20 years ago now, Robert Ballard discovered the only American carrier to be sunk at Midway, the USS Yorktown. And just in the last month, the research vessel Petrel continued its list of remarkable finds by discovering not just one, but two of the four Japanese carriers sunk in the battle. The next time you're in San Diego, I hope you'll visit the Midway Museum. It's moored just below the Broadway Pier, and you can spend all day there, thanks again to ship historian Carl Zingheim, for explaining some of how the Midway Museum preserves the history of the battle for which that ship was named. We actually did an entire episode at the Midway Museum a couple years ago, and you can access that, as well as any of our 600 episodes at hometownheroesradio.com. The major Hollywood production Midway opens in theaters November 8th, and how many people do you know who say, when a well-publicized film is about to debut, make sure you read the book before you watch the movie? There have been, of course, plenty of books written about the Battle of Midway, and here on Hometown Heroes, we've heard plenty of first-person perspectives on the battle, the prelude, the aftermath, the impact. And I thought hearing some of those today would be a good way to prepare for the Midway movie's debut. It's rated PG-13, by the way, mostly because of the realistic scenes of naval and aerial combat. Again, this battle took place just 6 months after Pearl Harbor, and four Japanese carriers that had launched the planes that devastated American forces at Oahu on December 7, 1941, would all be sunk at Midway in June of 1942. The big difference between Midway and Pearl Harbor was that this time the Americans had an idea of what was coming. That was thanks to cryptanalysts who believed they had cracked a Japanese code because of intercepted messages and how they were interpreted. Admiral Chester Nimitz had a pretty good guess of not just where Japan would attack, but when and with how much force. And there are so many what-ifs when it comes to World War II, but this is a big one. If you've studied the Battle of Midway at all, you know the aircraft carrier Enterprise and all the planes she launched played a major, major role in this pivotal American victory. But the Enterprise was there at full strength because of some providential weather 6 months earlier. The Big E was supposed to be at Pearl Harbor when the Japanese attacked in December. If it had been, it very likely would have not only been sunk, but would have trapped all the other ships in the harbor. At least that's what we heard here on Hometown Heroes from Merle Twible, who would later be credited with saving that famed aircraft carrier. He had been in the Navy since 1935.
Well, the Enterprise, we went to Hawaii then in 1939, and we'd been there, of course, a couple of years, and we were on the way back from Wake Island, where we had delivered the Marine fighter planes. And on the way back, we were due at the sea buoy at 0600 on the Sunday morning. Well, we got into a storm, and the destroyers with us had to ballast back down again until, so it delayed our arrival back to Pearl Harbor until 1600 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon at the sea buoy. Had we have been on time and hadn't stopped the fuel, the Enterprise would have been in Hospital Point, and we would have been blocked the whole Pearl Harbor, probably, because that's what the Japanese were looking for, and they wondered, where the hell are those aircraft carriers? Well, what we heard, we got there, and we heard something happen. We sent our air group into Pearl, and we said, it's just another Sunday drill. And here we are, we're wasting time. We want to get in and go on Liberty. And then pretty soon, some of our air group come back, and they said, this ain't no drill. And several of them then got shot down, and from there on, well, it was a matter of general quarters and get ready. And then we went into Pearl, actually, then Monday night. And if you've seen that mess, why, that was something. Then we stayed about 4 hours and took on fuel and ammunition and food stuff, and then we got back out of there. And, of course, we knew about the little submarines by that time. And that we went through Hospital Point making about 25 knots. We threw a wake clear up over the top of the deal when we went out. It was something.
Well, and you just said if you saw what that looked like at that time, you'd never forget it. What did you see when you headed into Pearl Harbor? I'm sure you could see the smoke from the Arizona, but was it shocking to you? I mean, could you believe your eyes? Did you have any concept of how significant this was in the big picture?
Well, by that time, we knew what had happened, how many planes had attacked, and it was just one of those things that happens to you in a lifetime, and you look at it, and you wonder how we're going to get out. But we got out of there, and then we went looking for the Japs, and finally, fortunately, we didn't find them because we weren't ready for anything. At that time, then, I was had the machine shop and the elevators and all that, and it was just a matter of going to general quarters and still in the repair parties and drilling like we were and just waiting to see what would happen. And, of course, that's the whole idea of everybody out there was just after when we got back out of Pearl, we milled around out there, what's going to happen? We wait and see. Actually, we prepared then to go out and to the Marshall Islands and bomb them. Well, in the meantime, all the bombs they had aboard the Enterprise were armor-piercing bombs. So they went over and they borrowed a bunch of bombs from the Army. Well, I was, of course, had the machine shop, and after they got them aboard, well, then they found out that the Navy fuses wouldn't fit the Army bombs. So I and the rest of people in the machine shop, we spent the next 3 or 4 days of making adapters so we could fit them into the bombs and screw our fuses on them. So we were pretty busy while we were headed for Wake Island and that. And then, of course, after we bombed the Marshall Islands and that, they secured from general quarters, and we thought, well, that's fix the Japs. But while we were up there looking at the islands burn, all of a sudden there was two twin end Mitsubishis came out, and they almost got the, they hit this after the star or port quarters of the fantail of the ship, and they started a fire back there, kind of touched it with their wing. Well, that's when we learned that, hey, those guys will crash on you if they get a chance. We didn't think anybody would do that, but we found that out. And then, of course, after that, then it was a matter of days and days, just seeking in the Battle of Midway. And then, which we were rebricking some boilers and doing a lot of repair work during the Battle of Midway, and the Yorktown got sunk.
And we're going to hear from a survivor of the USS Yorktown sinking in a bit, but I want to draw some more attention to what you heard Merle Twible say there. The bombs that sunk those four Japanese carriers at Midway, such as the Akagi, which was just discovered this month by the crew of the RV Petrel, had this adjustment in the machine shop of the USS Enterprise not taken place? Had Merle Twible and his crew not rethreaded all these fuse adapters, those American bombs, at least from the carrier Enterprise, might not have produced the same kind of results.
We had the bomb right there, and we could measure the threads and all of that, and that it was kind of like an adapter on a pipe fitting where you take it, and that's all it were threads. And we had to make an internal thread where our bomb fuse would screw in, and the one would screw into the Army bomb. And that, because what happened, they wanted these bombs to blow up above ground, not dig in the ground with our armor piercing. Because armor piercing, they'd just blow up a hole and that'd be it. And that was the reason they did it.
And I guess at that point, you'd probably gotten way past being nervous working around bombs. Is that anything that bothered you at first, the first time you had to work on a bomb?
No. Bombs and rockets and stuff on carriers and 100-octane gas is just something you live with. And if you catch somebody smoking, you push them over the side.
That was Merle Twible, who a few months after Midway would be credited with saving the most decorated ship in U.S. naval history, the USS Enterprise. That had to do with an adaptation to a breathing apparatus that greatly increased the ability to fight fires on the carrier. That came in very, very handy. Merle passed away in 2009, but you can access his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com to explore the rest of that unique contribution to the Enterprise's legendary record. Still to come, we'll hear from someone flying in one of the Big E's planes in the Battle of Midway, which will become known to a whole new generation of Americans thanks to the movie Midway, which opens in theaters November 8th. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing on the turning point of the Pacific War, the Battle of Midway, because of the major motion picture that hits theaters November 8th. Midway has an all-star cast with Dennis Quaid, Woody Harrelson, Luke Evans, and Nick Jonas, among others. But the cast of thousands who fought that battle 77 years ago included a whole lot of teenagers and quite a few aviators who had never experienced combat conditions before. Much has been made of Torpedo Squadron 8, which was nearly annihilated at Midway flying from the USS Hornet. George Gay was famously the sole survivor of those who flew with that squadron that day. Midway would mark the second time the Japanese claimed they had sunk the Big E, the USS Enterprise, the most decorated ship in history. The truth is, they never would sink her, but it would be dive bombers from the Big E that would help doom the final Japanese carrier at Midway. We heard earlier how the Enterprise was supposed to be at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, but was delayed by a storm, and a plane that helped sink that fourth and final carrier at Midway might not have had that opportunity if the morning of December 7th had gone a little differently. We learned that from Don Hoff, a rear-facing radio man gunner on an SBD aboard the Enterprise.
I was scheduled to go into Pearl Harbor on that morning on that search op. We the schedule showed that we were there, and we were especially going on there. But on that morning, there was a little bit of confusion, just was nothing really abnormal. But it caused us to the pilot to start up his engine a little bit sooner than what he ordinarily would have. He was maybe a little bit eager or whatever, and the engine probably ran maybe an extra 5 minutes. And now these are air-cooled engines, and the engine overheated. So when we get up to the takeoff spot, we're ready to go. When he turned up to full power, the engine became snapping and popping and cutting out. And the landing, the flight deck officer who gives the signal for you to go to wind up and then to launch, he questioned it. He looked at him and he said, "Well, what about it? You know, you can't hear because he's roaring. He's got the engine wound up." And Ensign Don Lale, he didn't want to down the plane but listening to it, he said, "Nah, we'll try it." So he nodded his head, and the landing officer or the flight deck officer nodded, "Go ahead." And he took off. And now we're going down the deck at full power, and this engine is popping and cutting and snapping and popping, and I'm thinking, I don't even like the sound of this thing because I know what happens. If the engine quits when you go off the end of the deck, you're going to go right in the water, and the ship is going to come right with the top of you. They won't slow down, never. And so I was very concerned about it, but we got about halfway down, and he realized that it wasn't going to work. It didn't clear up, so he cut the power and slammed on the brakes, and we stopped just short of the end of the flight deck. If we'd have gone another 5 or 10 feet, we'd have been right off into the water. But we got stopped, and they pushed the plane off to the side, pushed the tail into a little piece of channel iron that they have sticking out on there. They call it outrigger, and pushed the plane so that the rear end of the plane is sticking out over the water, and just the front wheels and just the very nose of the plane is sitting still on the flight deck. And that's where we sat while the others all took off. Now, of course, there's always one or two, or sometimes more, fellas who are standing by. And their engines are running, and they're ready to go. So in case something happens like that, they just substitute. We're out of service. They put another one right in there, and everything just keeps going on just without any interruption. So, of course, gave it a down on the plane, and that means a black mark against the plane captain. And he is not happy because he knows the plane is okay. He knows the engine is all right. So as soon as all the planes have taken off and they respot the deck, then he gets out there and he checks it. The pilot, in the meantime, gets out, and they finally got the deck. I finally got out of the plane. I didn't step out of the engine, or I still didn't step out of the cockpit until after they put the plane back up on the flight deck fully. I didn't want to step out because if I slipped, I'd be in the water 50 feet.
But because of those specific circumstances, you weren't one of the planes that flew into Pearl Harbor.
Right. We were not in the search op. And by the way, the plane, the crew that did replace us and took our position in there, they were shot down and killed. We knew that our planes were missing. We knew some of them had been shot down. We didn't have any radio contact with them. We knew they were gone, but we didn't know what had happened to them. It was just like you've been hit in the stomach with a 2x4, because everybody was shocked, and there was no laughter, and there were no jokes, and there were no anything kidding, or everything was extremely serious on board ship. And we knew we were really in trouble. We knew that to start off with. We had absolutely no idea how much damage had been done at Pearl Harbor.
They would soon find out, and 6 months later, they would have their chance to avenge that blow at Midway.
They did not tell us until on the morning of June the 4th. They didn't tell us what the situation was. The commanding officers knew, but they were sworn to secrecy. We knew that it was big, and we knew that we were going to be in trouble, and we would be contacting the enemy, and we were expecting the Japanese carriers, and we knew about when they were going to hit. And the naval intelligence had worked it out. They'd broken a Japanese code, and they were reading their mail. But on the morning of the June the 4th, we went out there, and we have approximately 150 to 200 miles. When we arrived at the location that it was supposed to be, the latitude and longitude, there wasn't anybody there. It was all clear, and you could see a long ways. And we didn't know at that time that there had been a one degree error in the navigation. And when they radioed the latitude and longitude, it was 1 degree off. And 1 degree off in that area is about 60 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't know it, but the Commander McCluskey, our air group commander, spotted a destroyer down in there, and he turned the ship and followed it, the course that it was on, and that led about another 20, 25 miles or so. It led us to the fleet, the main Japanese fleet, and we went in there, and the combat air patrol, which should have been up there to attack us before we got into position to dive, they were down on the surface. They were destroying the torpedo planes, the three squadrons of torpedo planes that had come in, and they were having a ball. They were just having a great time. Nobody looked up, and nobody paid any attention to. All of a sudden, there we were, and we were coming in. And the pilot, as he's looking down on these carriers, nobody had ever seen a Japanese carrier. And nobody ever had a Navy flight like that. So when the pilot looks down, he's got a lot of things to think of and a lot of things to do. He sees these little red blinky lights blinking at him, but he doesn't pay any attention to them. He knows they're shooting at him. But when we're riding backwards, and you got your machine guns out, and these tracers, when the tracers go by, zipping by you, they look like they're about 8 inches in diameter, and they look like they're coming right next to the plane. And I still swear to this day that some of those tracers went between the blades of it's a three-bladed prop on that propeller on that SBD, and some of those were right between the blades. It was so close to the fuselage that it just caused me to jump or to move. Flinch is about the closest way, just to flinch away from it.
That's exactly what you signed up for, right?
Yeah. No.
Going straight down backwards with bullets flying by you?
No. No, believe me. that was the time when I was thinking, of course we were scared. Some of the guys said, somebody said a long time ago that there's no atheists in foxholes,
mm-hmm.
and it's true. There are some. I'm sure that there are some rare guys who were not scared, but they wouldn't show it if they had to. But when we pulled out and our bomb missed, it was a near miss. When we pulled out and headed straight west, I was looking right broadside at that carrier, at that Japanese carrier, Kaga. And it was surreal. It was on fire, and there was explosions around, and there was smoke, and guys were running around, and I was supposed to strafe along the carrier. But I didn't strafe because looking at them, I thought, those people are, and if I strafe, they're going to know where I am. And that, it's dumb when you think about it. But if they may start shooting at me more than what they are. And I'll just be quiet and won't shoot, and I'll save my ammunition. It took us quite a while to get back into where the carrier was, the Enterprise. We had approximately five gallons of gas left, and we were the last plane to land from our group. We got a bite to eat, and then we were standing by, and when they finally went out, and the planes from the Hear You attacked the Yorktown. They found the Hear You, and they knew where it was. So we went out. It was late, probably 5 o'clock or so in the afternoon. And we lost approximately half of our squadron in the morning. There was a lot of other planes that were lost from bombing Squadron 6. Probably two-thirds were lost or more. But there were planes from the carrier Yorktown, and these were bombing 3 SBDs and some bombing five. So when the carrier Yorktown was attacked, they sent those planes over to the Enterprise and they said, land over there. So that's what they did. But when they landed, we adopted them right straight into our scouting squadron 6 and bombing squadron 6. We just flat out adopted them. So when we left in the afternoon to go out to finally attack the Hear You, we had a full squadron. We had two full squadrons of dive bombers. This time when we arrived out there, the Japanese Combat Air Patrol was up and they were nasty and they were ready to fight. And they knew that the three carriers we had hit in the morning were beyond repair. They were damaged. They were gone. And so they were going to do everything they possibly could to eliminate us from killing the fourth carrier. The carrier, they Hear You, knew we were coming, so the carrier was very evasive, with turning and twisting, and we came in out of sun, or up sun, but the Japanese attacked attacked the bombers before we got there. Personally, I was never attacked, but there were some of the other planes who were. I didn't get a chance to shoot at them because nobody came that close to me, which didn't make me the least bit mad. I wasn't unhappy at all. And we made our attack, and we got a direct hit on her. And we missed in the morning, but we got a direct hit in the afternoon. The pilot's at the controls, and he's flying the plane straight down at about 250 miles an hour. And I'm in the back seat, riding backwards with my gun, my machine gun's out, so in case we're attacked by fighter planes, while we're in the dive, I have an opportunity to shoot him. The one thing that, one job that the rear gunner has to have that he does for the pilot is diving. He can't change his eyes. He's got his eyes up at the gun sight, and he can't look down there to watch and see what all the instruments show. I have to read off the elevation starting at 10,000 feet. I call every 1,000 feet, 10, 9, 8, right on down to the line. Until at 3,000 feet, I call standby, and at 2,000 feet, I call mark. And, of course, he's supposed to start pulling out. Well, sometimes he's not in precisely the position he's wanting to be in, but he's going 250 miles an hour. He doesn't have any maneuvering time. He's got to have it squared away by then to where he's aiming to where he thinks the carrier is going to be when his bomb hits the water. He wants to get low so he can make sure it gets a good hit, so he may go as low as 1,500 feet. And at 1,500 feet, when he pulls out, he's pulling 6, 7, 8 times the force of gravity in the back seat. He doesn't get that much up in front, but in the back seat, because you're behind the wing, there's more gravity pull than there is up in front. But he pulled out, and he was right flat on the water. The way I always did it, I would count four, standby, mark, 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 and I'd yell real loud.
You don't want to take a chance that he doesn't hear you.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. There's noise, there's engine noise, and I wanted to make sure that he heard me. And, of course, if he didn't hear me, if he'd have been shot, he would go straight in, you wouldn't worry about it. You know, I mean, you didn't have any time really to think about it. But we pulled out, and, of course, we headed back toward the carrier because we knew that the damage that we had done to that carrier, we could see the bomb damage. We knew there wasn't any chance of those fighters were going to land on that carrier, and they weren't going to come after us anymore. We knew there was a feeling that we have really done our job right because we've got the fourth carrier out of four, so we're home free.
The battle would last another 3 days, and Japanese reinforcements would come. But by sinking four of the six carriers the Japanese had in their entire fleet in the course of one fateful day, those courageous Americans turned the tide in the war in the Pacific. When you head to the movies next week to see Midway on the big screen, remember the men whose voices you heard today. And remember all of those who did not return to tell their stories, especially the more than 300 who sacrificed their lives for a pivotal victory at Midway. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.